Hey everyone, this is Scott Spinelli and you are listening to I'm Sure I'm Overthinking, the Season 2, Episode 10, the final episode. We made it. I know, I'm as stunned as you are, trust me. This is the final episode, 10 episodes, as I said. I would think that Season 3 will come out based on everything that's happened thus far in 2024. That'll be a 5-episode season. This one was 10, the first one in 2016 was 15. I think the ultimate goal at this point is to just have a Season 4 that's 0 episodes in 2028. Here's hoping. This episode is featuring none other than Scott Spinelli. And no, I have not adopted a third-person pattern of speech. It is actually a man named Scott Spinelli, who is not me, who is the assistant coach of men's basketball at BC. And I have been aware of him. As a matter of fact, even just now when I was searching his name to find his Twitter account so that I could tell you that it is at @coach_Spinelli, his is the first one that comes up, even though there are other Scott Spinellis that, in fact, prevented us from having one of us from having the handle of @ScottSpinelli. I wanted that handle years ago, couldn't get it. This is why he doesn't have it either. I'm Spinelli_Scott. He is Coach_Spinelli because there is a... this is obviously thrilling information for all of you out there, but it just suffices to say that, there's more of us than I thought. He's the interesting one, though, right? He has a wealth of experience at the college level. He's an assistant men's basketball coach, as I said, at BC, but he has been at Maryland, Texas A&M, Wichita State, Nebraska, and a host of other places, experiences at the pro and college level. I've been aware of him simply by virtue of the fact that I've looked myself up. I mean, who hasn't done that? And he would come up. I mean, like I said, he comes up when I search for my own Twitter handle. He's there. In many ways, he's always been there when I've looked up my own name online. And so I thought it'd be fun to interview someone with the same name as me. But then when we got to talking, I realized, well, this is just fun to sort of dig into the mind of a guy who's got a ton of basketball experience and is a sharp recruiter, sharp coach, sort of fun to dig into that. And that's what we were able to do. But more than that, I think, and I can speak for myself here, it'll be fun to just be a fan of another Scott Spinelli going forward, following his career at BC and wherever else he winds up throughout his career. I think it'd be really great to one day say, hey, Scott Spinelli, national champion. So at any rate, it was a lot of fun to talk with someone with the same name as me, but also just regardless of that, it was a fun time sort of chopping it up about basketball and his career. For about an hour. So, for the final time this season, at the very least, without further ado, here's my conversation with Scott Spinelli. All right, so for years, I've done what most egotistical people do and look myself up on the internet, and unfortunately, there seems to be someone who keeps coming up on the search platforms more than me. For my own name, which I think is a little unfair because Scott Spinelli is kind of an individual name, but apparently it's not. And I have the good fortune of talking to the other Scott Spinelli, as I've so kindly referred to him as over the years. Have you ever looked me up online? I mean, I know you've looked yourself up, but you've seen me, I assume, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think, my children are really into the social media side, and sometimes they get Google alerts of Scott Spinelli. And so... I've been on the other side of this where my daughter especially or my youngest son will come up and say, hey, Dad, you got this Google alert, and you were, talking about something to do with baseball or something. But yeah, it had nothing to do with me. So I did do some research on you based on that. And, it's really kind of neat to be able to talk to somebody who does have, the same first and last name. Real interesting.
Well, let's get a couple of things out of the way to make sure to people that this isn't me just throwing my voice. And we are, in fact, two separate people. What is your middle name?
I'm Anthony.
Ooh, Alexander. See, close. Okay.
Oh, my God.
So same initials.
We've got one thing in common. Thank God. Our names weren't Anthony Scott Spinelli or
yes.
Alexander Scott, because your initials would have been something that we never would have wanted to put on anything.
No, for sure. My sister's name is Abby, but thankfully her middle name, my parents were nice enough and they gave her the middle name of Beth. So that was close, but
that's funny.
Yeah, she's a close one. I mean, she may in fact be that acronym, but her name is not. What about you grew up in the Massachusetts area?
Yeah, so I grew up in Massachusetts. I I come from a family of six, you know, and, you know, I get into this, you know, coaching basketball thing, you know, right after college. And I've kind of, you know, done the gamut in terms of being in, you know, prep schools, you know, slash high school, been a head coach at that level, and then done the gamut of, you know, being at the low major Division One to mid major Division One to the high major, as well as some minor league pro experience in basketball, as well as the NBA. So kind of done the whole gamut over the last several years.
I've seen lately that you've, I mean, I know right now you're at BC, but previously to that, you were with Mark Turgeon for a while, Wichita State, Texas A&M, Maryland. What was the connection there like? What was that? Because you followed him to a couple different places. Let's talk about that connection.
Okay, so, you know, throughout the years, you know, in, you know, the networking side of this business, you know, I developed some good relationships with, you know, being at Winchendon, which is, you know, in Massachusetts, probably about 35 to 40 miles or so east of UMass in Amherst, Mass. John Calipari was someone that I ended up, you know, developing a good relationship with over the years. And from his relationship, you know, I met some of his contacts, Coach Larry Brown. And through Coach Brown and his contacts, I met, you know, Mark Turgeon years ago at a coach's clinic down in Memphis, in where it was an invite only. And I was able to go down there, network a little bit. And since then, you know, Mark Turgeon and I, Turge, as I'll call him, have been, you know, good friends. And I've worked for Turge at three different universities. You know, we've won a lot of games together, had a lot of success together. And, you know, he's still at Maryland. I'm at Boston College. But, you know, he's somebody that I've worked for. I know him very well as, you know, his family. My family still is in contact with his family through, you know, a lot of different social media, phone conversations, I'm sure. So, yeah, that's kind of how I, you know, met Turge.
Now, what was the reason to split off after the three different stops and go to BC? What made going to BC so appealing in that way?
Well, a lot of different factors go into this. I think first and foremost with Boston College, you know, I'm from this area. And I think, you know, having a chance to come back, you know, to where your roots are, was very attractive to my family. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Coach Christian, you know, really put forth, Coach Christian, Boston College, put forth an incredible offer from myself and my family. And I think those two things had a lot to do with it. And, you know, look, as a third reason, I you know, as a coach, as an assistant, you're always trying to, you know, move up the ladder to try to get a chance someday to be your own head coach. And I think I had been with Turge for, you know, again, 8 years, three different universities. And although I was very close on a few, finished second on some head coaching jobs, I think at some point you kind of need to reinvent yourself a little bit. So that had another, you know, it was another reason why too, in the decision to come to Boston College that my family and I made.
So a lot of the research I've done on you, when I'm not actually lying and just looking up pictures of myself on the internet, is that you have a reputation as a hell of a recruiter. And I've seen quotes from a lot of, I want to steer this for a second towards some of the NBA players that have made it as far as, you know, at your various stops, Texas A&M and Maryland and in BC. What do you think it is? Because I've heard you say a version of that you're not as big on recruit rankings. When you go and look up some of these, when you're recruiting, what's one thing you're looking for that the average fan you think isn't probably watching in a game? Because I always feel like people who just look at points are completely missing the point, so to speak, I guess. What's one thing that you look at when you're recruiting?
Well, there's just a couple of small things I'll mention there. First of all, I think, again, being in this profession as many years as I've been in it, you're going to make mistakes. No matter what, you know, profession you're in, you're going to make mistakes. And the important thing is to learn from them. And, you know, when I was a younger coach, I was actually putting a team together at prep schools where I was recruiting players and, you know, really learned by making mistakes in the fact that a lot of times I was evaluating players and it was basically solely on, you know, their points, their statistics. And that's kind of how I was looking at putting a team together. And I couldn't have been more wrong at a younger age. So when I go out and recruit now, the most important things that I'm able to kind of see, first of all, is to see kind of past the situation that each player is playing within. And what I mean by that is, look, every coach, you know, has a system, high school, AAU, junior high, and each player is trying to conform to that system to play to the style that the coach wants him to play, that ultimately, hopefully, puts that team in a position where they're winning games. And I think sometimes lost in this are the players who are playing within a system, you know, in under these, you know, conditions that their coach is instructing them to play under, is, you know, what's lost is that they can do a lot more than they actually show due to the fact that they're playing within a system.
Sure, sure.
So that's kind of what I try to do, is see past the individual statistics and see what I think that kid or young man could do in our situation based on how we're going to need him to play.
Now, one thing I've lamented, I went to Syracuse University, and one thing I've lamented, and I totally, by the way, to be clear, I totally get why some of these guys, at least at Syracuse University, have jumped to go to the pros. If someone was offering me the opportunity of that magnitude, I would probably take it too, or at least take a chance on taking it. However, there are a lot of guys, when they do stay, you get to know them better as a fan, but more importantly, they also get to develop as basketball players. One example I always make when thinking of my time at Syracuse from 2004 to 2008 was a guy like Andy Routens, who was barely playable towards the beginning and became an excellent player for them by the end. Who was a guy that you brought on? I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of them, but a couple that you can think of that, like, wow, the progress they made even exceeded your expectations.
Well, I think it all starts with Chris Middleton for me. I mean, Chris was a young man that went to a small private school down in Charleston, South Carolina, Port of God High School. And it's a very prestigious private school down there that's really based on, you know, the academic side of it, smaller classrooms. You know, was very well coached at the time by JP, Coach Pearson. And, you know, he was kind of under the radar, whereas a lot of the teams, specifically the, you know, the state universities and a lot of those ACC, SCCC teams down in that area never gave Chris much interest at all. And a lot of it had to do with maybe his disposition and where he was at the time as a player. But to see what Chris has been able to do, obviously at A&M, he really helped us. We had the best four-year win total at A&M in A&M's history. We averaged almost 25 wins a game over those 4 years. And Chris, you know, was a part of that, big part of that. But to see what he did for us, you know, coming from high school, going to A&M, and, you know, what we're able to accomplish there and the time we were together, and then see where he is today in the NBA, I think he is somebody that would be the, you know, the centerfold towards somebody that, you know, again, has really surpassed any expectations that most people had, including even us to a certain degree.
How much of that was related to any potential growth spurt or just work ethic or both?
Well, I think it's a combination of work ethic and character. I think, you know, the longer you're in this, I know everybody, there's a lot of, you know, cliches out there, but, you know, a kid like Chris, who was brought up from, you know, with a tremendous upbringing by his family, both his parents, tremendous people, sister is a big part of his life even today. You know, he had tremendous character, and coupled with work ethic, I think those two qualities, and then you add in the belief that Chris had, you know, in himself, I think that's kind of the makeup of somebody, you know, that, again, you know, he obviously had some good size to him. He had some athleticism to him. But I think those three qualities, you know, with character, work ethic, and then, you know, the side of this that a lot of people don't realize is, you know, if some young man is really willing to, you know, at times go through a little of adversity and, you know, continue on the path, I think that side of it, too, is where Chris was incredible. He continuously worked towards his goals through the ups and downs of getting there. And I think that's a tremendous side of what Chris has been able to do.
I mean, in all honesty, right, there is no way that when you were recruiting him, or when you first saw him on campus, I should say, that you thought this guy is going to be a max player in the NBA, right? There's just no way that, or can you see something like that? I mean, is that, after you've seen it so much and you've coached at the highest level there is, you know, you've scouted for in the pros, as you've said, you know, you've done almost everything there is to do in the professional basketball ranks, so to speak, and college ranks. Can you see something like that or the potential for it? Or is it more just, you know, you sort of dream on it and, you know, let the rest, let the chips fall where they may?
Oh, you know what? I think, first of all, with Chris, we had a vision for Chris that he was going to become something special. We really did. At the same time, you know, there's so many other factors that go into this, you know, that, you know, you really can't control, you know, somebody's health and, you know, their positioning in terms of what team they get to in the NBA. There are things that you really can't control. But we did have a vision that Chris was going to be what we would consider a special type of player. But I don't think anybody would have thought that he would be, you know, an NBA All-Star, a max level player, and somebody that's made, you know, the impact he's made on the floor night in and night out in the NBA when we first started recruiting him. And again, most of this credit goes to Chris and the work ethic, you know, his character, and then the determination to go through all of the, you know, the adversity, ups and downs on a kid that was, you know, kind of overlooked in the draft. A lot of people didn't. And even in the trade that Detroit traded him to Milwaukee, I think he was just a throw-in player at the time.
Oh, yeah.
They really, uh-huh. You know, so yeah, a lot of this credit goes to Chris, you know, Scott, in this process.
You mentioned that, you know, there are some things out of your control, and that's kind of where I wanted to go next. I always find it really fascinating to sort of dig into both why a player makes it, but also why some guys don't. I mean, you see some guys in college who seem like slam dunks. Like, I mean, that's a obvious metaphor to make, but they, you know, like they just, how could this guy not be a really good player? And I'll give an example from my time while I sort of long, obviously the question is going to be geared towards you in a second, but my example would be, I never understood why, do you remember Joe Alexander from West Virginia?
Yeah.
I thought he was excellent, and I just, and he was gone so fast. And what I mean by never made it in the NBA is not, if there's some sort of, you know, why they won't be a superstar, that is a different hurdle to clear entirely. But it was, I could never figure out why it is that, as an example, he did not make it to a 7 to 10 year NBA career as just, you know, sort of making stops along the way, right? I've always wondered why that is the case with certain guys. Can you shed some light on that? Why it is that certain guys might not make it, or why it is, you know, outside of the obvious injury concerns, why it is that certain guys just, what's some of the stumbling blocks that like a regular fan might not really know about as to what's going on?
Well, again, I think goes back to those qualities we just talked about. I mean, look, a lot of these kids and, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these kids are getting labeled, you know, some of them fairly, some of them unfairly in terms of ranking at a young age. A lot of times, you know, people judge a kid's success or their performance by, you know, statistics only, points per game, you know, assists, rebounds. And I think the biggest thing that, you know, happens a lot of times, and this, again, I was guilty of this, especially when I was a younger coach, is just looking at things from an analytical standpoint. There's so much more that goes into, you know, the evaluation process and, you know, talking about how a player is used. You know, if somebody is putting up huge numbers and, you know, their coach or their system is allowing him or her to come off screens or putting the ball in their hands every possession, you know, somebody's probably going to put up great stats. Now, again, you know, how that translates to the next level might not be the case, you know, depending upon, you know, the system that he, you know, goes to, you know, as it relates to the pro side of this in the NBA. So, you know, there is a lot more of this, you know, as it just not just the analytics side of this. And I think that's what happens with people. They get caught up in the analytics, you know, and we see all these analytics in the NBA. And I'm not saying that analytics aren't important. They are. But, you know, there's other things that go into this. And I think if you can see past what a player is doing on the floor, and then look at them and say, what are they capable of doing if given that opportunity or putting them in a system where they're going to be allowed to do those things? I think that's a bigger side of this evaluation process as opposed to what a player is just doing in their situation.
Yeah, I think a perfect example of that would be a guy like Jerome Robinson, who's now on the Wizards, right? With the Clippers beforehand, where did he get picked? 13th, 14th, somewhere in the top half of the draft, right? Was it?
He was the first lottery pick ever taken out of Boston College. Now, again, lottery is, you know, is somewhat modern day, but
sure,
you
but
know,
still, yeah.
Tremendous accomplishment for Jerome to be that, you know, classified under that. Made history there at Boston College with the great history of BC does have in men's basketball.
Yeah, no, and he was the kind of guy who, when he got traded, he was involved in, I believe, a three-team trade with the Knicks and the Wizards and the Clippers. And when he got traded, I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about this guy. I mean, I love watching the NBA draft every year. And then I saw he had some really big game with the Wizards. He hit some, you know, big shot. And I think he falls into that category of what you're describing as a guy who really probably just needs an opportunity more so than an actual quote-unquote bust based on what he was doing, because he really wasn't given an opportunity with the Clippers, not through any fault. It might just not be the right situation there. That's all. I mean, would you think that he's that kind of a guy?
Yes, I think, you know, I think both of the kids that we've had at Boston College, Jerome Robinson and Kai Bowman, you know, are, you know, typify what we just talked about. And, you know, using them as examples of, you know, being in a situation where, you know, they could be used a certain way within how we played, how Coach Christian played here at Boston College and how we used Jerome. You know, he put up, you know, incredible numbers here throughout his, you know, his time here. But to get to an NBA team now, you know, hopefully that NBA team, wherever he goes, you know, he's going to be used, you know, similarly or to a certain degree like that. And I think in Jerome's case, you know, right now with the Wizards, you know, he's shown that if given an opportunity to play to his strengths, you know, I think he can really, you know, make a major impact. And, you know, similarly, you know, Kai Bowman, you know, somebody asked me in an interview way back when, you know, Kai Bowman, what do you think about him? And my answer to him was, look, I think Kai Bowman is going to be minimum a 10-year NBA player. And the reasons have nothing really to do with the analytics. The reasons have to do more with, you know, what's between his chest. I mean, his heart will not allow him to fail. And again, you know, with that determination we talked about earlier, with his work ethic, and then you put character on the other side of it, besides all the physical attributes, you know, I think in Kai's case, you know, when used, like even this year with Golden State, he was given an opportunity, kind of unexpected, and he showed what he could do at that level. So, yeah, I think those two kids in particular, you know, typify, you know, what we just talked about.
I mean, the idea of between, you know, the sort of how big your heart is, that idea, I think it's, I mean, I think you're 100% right, obviously. Like, I think at the NBA level, and even at the collegiate level, like, you're clearly a very good player, right? You are among the cream of the crop. And then at every next step, there's obviously a higher level. But the NBA sort of is it. And if you get to that level, a lot of what separates people, it seems to me, is effort, right? I mean, not just effort. Obviously, some of it is talent, right? I mean, LeBron James is always going to be better than most people. He just happens to be that great. But that doesn't come out of nowhere, right? The effort is really what separates certain guys. Because once you get there, some people just, you know, through no fault of their own, are just happy to make a good living, you know, play hard, but that's not their whole life. It's sort of the, you know, the difference I've been hearing a lot about between, you know, after Kobe Bryant's passing, the difference between, let's say, like a Kobe Bryant and a Vince Carter, right? That Kobe Bryant may have not been as talented as Vince Carter, but no one on earth wanted it more than Kobe Bryant.
No question. I agree with that. I agree with that. That, to me, right there, what you just said, has so much to do with, you know, every sport. And, you know, it really translates to life and translates to all aspects, coaching. You know, I think for most players in their respective sports, if people or players think that they have reached their pinnacle, that they are the best at what they do, and they let their guard down, you know, that's when somebody else is always out there working harder than you. Their determination is more than what, you know, you have, just because you think that you've made it already. And it's those the people, the players that just continue to keep working, even though they are considered to be, you know, one of the best, if not the best, or if they're still trying to get to the top. That mindset always, you know, to me, you know, supersedes any player that, you know, has made it, but yet has lost that work ethic or that edge, or doesn't think that they need to develop more.
Now, one more player-specific question before I want to dive into exactly what an assistant coach does. You've coached for a long time. Give me somebody other than the obvious, like, you'll see where I'm going with this, but who is the best player, or excuse me, the toughest player you've ever had to game plan against? So I don't want you to, you know, I would never say to you something like, tell me a player that disappointed you that you coached. We're not, this is just a positive thing. Want to know, you're going into a game plan, and other than like an obvious, you know, player of the year candidate, who was someone that you thought, wow, this guy is a real handful to game plan against?
Boy, I tell you what, you know, there's so many players that come to mind, and even, you know, teams over the years, because you've been in so many, you know, big time games. But I'll tell you what, you know, when we played UCLA in the NCAA tournament, and we played them in the second round, we actually played them out in Anaheim. You know, the player that really, at that time, was probably one of the most difficult matchups, because at the end of the day, the game of basketball is about matchups.
Yeah,
right?
Sure, of course, yeah.
It's who, you know, matching up to somebody that is the size of somebody like Kevin Love when he was at UCLA. You know, he had all the physical attributes. He was somebody that was, you know, playing multiple positions. If you put a bigger guy on him, he would take you to the three-point line, and you know, or beat you off the dribble. If you put a smaller guy on him and tried to get underneath him, he would take you to the post. So I think in the end, a guy like Kevin Love was probably the toughest matchup that I've seen, you know, over my time as a coach, just because of, you know, at the time he was at UCLA, what he brought to the table as it relates to his skill level, his skill set, his size, and his versatility.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about exactly what it is an assistant coach does, because I think, quite honestly, as a big fan of basketball, I'm pretty ignorant of this, and I'm sure a lot of people are too. I mean, in many ways, assistant coaches are like the offensive linemen of the sport, in that we know they're very important, but not many of us know exactly what they do. Going into a game, you know, you're playing, you got a big game on a Wednesday. Tell me what the assistant coach, let's talk about some of the responsibilities of the assistant coach, like before the game, and then we'll go into in the game.
Okay. So usually in the coaches I've worked, first of all, I've worked for some excellent coaches, over the years. You know, Joe B. Wright, I worked with two different stops, Barry Collier, at Nebraska, you know, Mark Turgeon, Jimmy Christian. And I've been around some really good basketball minds. As an assistant coach, you know, what really excites you from a coaching standpoint is when, you know, most assistant coaches, they get assigned, or we choose, you know, the scouting assignments that we're going to have, you know, during the course of the year. And so when it's your time to scout an opponent, basically, you're, you know, watching film, you're looking at all of the offensive, defensive strategies that that particular team has, and it's your job to implement a game plan on both ends of the floor. And so that's the one time that as an assistant coach, you really get a chance to kind of, you know, impact the strategy of a game by sitting down with the head coach and putting together the game plan that it would take to beat that opponent. That right there is something that all assistant coaches do. The second thing is, you know, for assistant coaches is, and most important for all assistants, is your job is to assist the head coach in any which way, shape, or form that he needs or she needs to, as it relates to trying to help the program move forward and win. Most times you're going to get judged as an assistant on your recruiting work, because at the end of the day, you know, especially whether it's college or MBA, you know, it's usually the team that has the better players usually is going to win or you know, win more games than lose during that time. So your job is to kind of make sure that you recruit to the highest level possible. And then the other side of it is player development, you know, really working on, you know, developing players, whether it's individual workouts, whether it's, you know, pre-practice, you know, whether you're in the body of practice, you know, getting a group of players, whether it's the big guys, the guards, your middle wings, and really trying to work on their skill development. So, you know, assistant coaches have their hands in all aspects of the program, but probably the most fun, you know, besides, you know, recruiting and the relationships that you establish, the most fun and most impact that you probably have is when you get a chance to kind of implement a game plan when it's your respective scout.
When about recruiting for a second, what's the toughest part of recruiting? What would you say is the hardest part for you as when it comes to the process of recruiting?
Well, I'll tell you what, in recruiting, you know, the toughest part is, you know, trying to, you know, to really go out and evaluate a player and then dealing with, you know, trying to communicate that player to that family, to that support system, that what, you know, your university and what you guys have to offer is going to be better than, you know, all the other schools that are recruiting them. So, you know, first and foremost, evaluating the player is, you know, is difficult. In men's basketball, especially, there's a lot of different variables, that you have to kind of, you know, kind of know what you're doing here, you know, because the last thing you want to do is be recruiting somebody and, you know, you're kind of recruiting, wasting your time. So you've got to evaluate the reality of being able to get the player. And, you know, there's a lot of other factors that go into it. But, you know, again, learning throughout the years, the experience that you get is you kind of learn, you know, how to kind of go through this process. But recruiting is a very difficult job in the college game, and especially at the higher levels. And again, now that you, if you get that network and you've got credibility, your best and worst advertisement will always be word of mouth. And so the longer you're in this, if you can build up credibility, and I've been blessed to be able to be around a lot of really good players that, you know, you can use that as your means of attracting the next under the radar, quote unquote, you know, special type talent.
What's the strangest story you have from recruiting? Meaning like, you know, you were invited to someone's home and they served you strange food, or you had to deal with this third cousin's, you know, fifth uncle once removed, or has there ever been just like a what is going on here type story?
Yeah, I've got a couple. The story when I went over to recruit in Mali, West Africa.
Okay.
And I speak a little French. Je parle vous français un peu. I had to travel through Paris, France. And what happened was, this was my first trip over there. And I was going to recruit a young man by the name of Saliu Benetelli, who actually played for us at American University. But when I went over there, the flight from Paris to Bamako, Mali, had been canceled. So I'm at Charles de Gaulle Airport waiting, you know, to see when the next flight's going to be. And 30 minutes later, the flights, you know, decides, or the airline decides they're actually going to go. And it was kind of a weird, you know, situation. I'm like, gee, they just canceled it. And so I got on a plane. There weren't many people on the plane. So I don't know if people thought it was canceled and they just assumed it and went on a different flight. I don't know what happened, but so needless to say, I had contacted my office and said, look, could you let them know that I'm not going to be arriving in Mali because the flight was canceled?
Okay.
So I end up going on the flight. I arrive at it was really late in the evening, almost early morning in Bamako. And I had no ride. I had no transportation. And I was in West Africa for the first time. You know, having to get from the airport to what they called Le Grand Hotel in Bamako without having any connection was a was one that I'll never forget that night. And, you know, when I got to the airport, I ended up, there was all these different types of transportation services offering their service. I had no idea who understood English and where I was even going. So I trusted this younger kid for some reason. And he brought me to a car service, which I don't even know was legitimate car service. But I got in the car, Scott, and, you know, there were fumes coming up from underneath the engine. And I had to put my head out the window. So I put my head out the window, and then I'm driving through areas that, you know, were a little, you know, a little different than, you know, being back in the States where I was familiar, and people were looking at me and I'm looking at them. I'm just trying to breathe as I'm going to the hotel. And so finally I get to the hotel, and then the next day I end up going on the recruiting side of it. And then we went to eat at his house, and they brought a fish from the Nile River. With its head and his eyes in the fish on the table. And that's, they eat, there was definitely some food that I had never seen, and I actually had to taste some of it to be respectful. So that was probably the craziest story for me in recruiting.
Oh wow. I have to say I was expecting something very different than that. You know, I think that's an incredible story. Yeah, I think a lot of times too, what people forget about probably when you tell a story like that is there were no smartphones when you were doing that, most likely, right? You weren't able to just Google your way in your palm to get to where you need to go. So that was just a complete, you know, see what happens and hope for the best type story.
Yeah, no question. That was one I'll never forget. But what a great experience. And, you know, I met so many wonderful people over there and, you know, West Africa, specifically Mali along the way. And to this day, I have, you know, tremendous relationships with a lot of the, I ended up recruiting several kids from over there. And, you know, again, Salyu Benetelli is in the States now. He graduated from American University, and he works for he's an engineer for the Navy. And so, yeah, it was worthwhile. But yeah, that was probably the strangest experience that I've ever had in recruiting.
Let's talk some quick hitters here as we go. A couple things. What is one thing you'd like to change about college basketball? And then, as I'm sure you follow the NBA closely, what's one thing you would change about NBA basketball? Like maybe one thing that I almost hesitate to call them two separate sports, but you get where I'm going with that the two things could sort of learn from one another.
Well, look, in the college game, I mean, the one thing that really makes this it makes it really difficult is the recruiting landscape. So what I mean by that is, you know, in college, it's really hard, you know, to recruit, for example, let's just say ranked kids. Or kids who are considered to be top 50, top 100 kids to certain schools, because, you know, some of these kids are fairly or unfairly ranked, you know, in a way that they believe that, you know, they belong at, you know, most of the blue bloods or, you know, those type of levels of school. And, you know, I think the ranking system in college, goes to high school. And I think that's the one thing that I truly believe, that it's hard to rank a kid. Some kids, everybody develops at a different pace. Some kids physically, mentally develop faster than others. And, you know, once a kid gets ranked at a younger age, you know, it's hard for that kid to, number one, you know, understand that, you know, in order to become great, that ranking can only get you so far. You've got to stay on the path of working hard, you know, what got you to that ranking. Sometimes it's hard for these younger kids to understand that and to really pursue, you know, vigorously their goals, because they feel like, or people around them are telling them, that they've already made it. So the college game, I think, ranking these younger kids, especially the young ones, I'm talking about, there's rankings now in the 7th, 8th grade, 9th grade.
That feels absurd to me. That feels absurd.
Yeah. I think that's a hard, I think that's really hard for kids to be able to deal with, you know, at a younger age. So I think that's the one thing that I would tell you, the recruiting side of this in terms of the rankings makes this, you know, it makes it really hard for kids to to be able to go through, you know, something like that at a younger age. And that's what I would probably see if there was, could be some reform on. And I know it's probably impossible to do, but, you know, I think the ranking system is something that, you know, could be a, you know, something that could be a little bit different in college. That's my opinion. The NBA game, I think for me personally, you know, look, I'm a big, you know, I love watching all levels of basketball, and there's nothing like watching playoff basketball in the NBA. It's very intense. I think the amount of games that the NBA plays, I think it's a little excessive, and I get, look, I, you know, everybody's, it's a business, I get it, but you're dealing with, you know, with athletes, and, you know, these players and their bodies, they do need some time to regenerate. And I think playing back-to-back games and as many games as they do, traveling, it takes a toll on the guys. And I think, you know, maybe we'd see even a more intense game, you know, just in the regular season if, you know, we could maybe limit the amount of games, you know, that the kids, that the pro players play in during a season.
Oh, I mean, absolutely agree. I think the only reason that doesn't happen is what you said. I mean, the fact that it is a business, right? And you're going to have a situation where there's just no way that they're going to take down the total profits. But if it was just in the interest of making the game better, I mean, there's nothing quite like the intensity of a college basketball season, because 30 is in that nice sweet spot, or I know it's not exactly 30, but in the 30s, low 30s amount of games is that sweet spot where it's every game isn't make or break, but it's still very important. And I think that would be something that the NBA certainly, I mean, again, it probably won't happen, but that would be a fun thing just to see at the very least. Where do you stand on any sort of potential, as I know this has been bandied about, any potential limiting or enforcing of a rule where kids would have to stay for a certain amount of time?
Well, I was if you look back at, you know, the NBA game, you know, when college had the rule that the players had to stay until they completed their junior year, you know, the kids that were getting out of college going to the NBA were men. They were ready. And the NBA game, to me, was even that much better, just because, you know, the players were older, they were more experienced, and they understood the intensity level and the work ethic that it takes, you know, that it took to get there. And so I think, again, I would love to see, you know, and it will probably never happen, but I'd love to see the, you know, rule of the kids having to stay, you know, until after their junior year, and then getting to the NBA, going to the NBA from there. I just think, looking back, you know, there's only one chance you get to go to college, and I think it's probably the best 4 years or the best few years of your life. And when you jump into the NBA, and I get it, you know, it's a lot of money, and I get all that, but, you know, it becomes a business, it becomes a job, as opposed to that college experience that kids can fall back on you know, for the rest of their life. So I think there's a couple things that go into that decision for me.
All right, one last quick hitter before we wrap up here. Obviously, you mentioned that it's every assistant coach's sort of end goal to be a head coach somewhere. Do you have aspirations of working at the pro level more as a head coach? Or as a, you know, if I could grant you a wish right now, you could go coach in the pros, coach in the NBA. Now, I realize that in certain cases, the money is a factor, but just in terms of the game, you know, excluding money, where would be your absolute preferential spot to be a head coach?
Well, for me personally, I've set goals like any other, you know, player, probably any other coach. And, you know, right now, my goals are very simple. I have a goal right now that I'd like to get to a place in college and make a run at a national title somewhere. I've seen it done at, you know, places like, you know, mid-major plus schools that people thought were never going to be great, who have now turned into places where, you know, you can get to a Final Four and try to win a national title. So that's one of my goals. And from there, you know, if the opportunity came to continue on, you know, to an NBA position, that would be, again, later on. But right now for me, you know, I'm experienced. Although, you know, I've been at every level, I've learned quite a bit along the way. I've been blessed to be around a lot of good players and learn from my mistakes. And I'm really eager to get going here to try to win a national title someplace as a head coach in college.
All right. Well, Scott, we've come to approximately the end. And as I usually do at the end of these interviews, I'm going to stall here for a second to give you a chance to think of something. But what I always do at the end here, at the end of every job interview that you go on, what do they always ask at the very end? Do you have any questions for me? Right. And you've always spent the entire interview sort of asking all of the follow-up questions you could possibly think of, and you don't have any, but you don't want to say, no, I don't have any questions, because you don't want to look like you have nothing to say. So in lieu of that long question, or I should say preamble to a question, I will, as we wrap up here, I will say to you, do you have any questions for me?
You know, Scott, I really don't. You know, I honestly got to tell you, I think, you know, getting a chance to talk with you as another Scott Spinelli has kind of been the, you know, it's been a first. And, you know, knowing a little bit about your background from just the, like you said, the Google searches, and, you know, you've been a, you know, it sounds like you're on a very successful path to your, you know, on your career. And it's really kind of neat to see, you know, somebody else with the same name and both of us striving towards our goals. So very unique interview. And I enjoyed, you know, spending some time talking to another person named Scott Spinelli.
All right, everybody, that was Scott Spinelli. Coach_Spinelli on Twitter is where you can find him. That was a lot of fun. It really was. Like I said at the top, I'm a BC fan now. I really am. And I'm going to be a fan of his wherever it is that he ends up. And I look forward to, you know, any successes he has, because I just think it was it's cool that he has the same name as me. I know it's corny, but it's cool. It is. It's one of those things where I've never really found someone who has the same birthday as me that fascinating, although I did meet someone once who had the exact same birthday as me, a teacher at a school that I substitute taught at once, and that was kind of funny. But this is much more interesting than that, I think. The exact same name, the same middle name, too? I mean, come on. Either way, nothing but the best of luck and future successes to him. This is it for us. This is the end of the road for this season. The music credit for this podcast all season has gone to Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. Song title, Octo Blues. Full credit information in the description of this episode and, quite frankly, all the other episodes from this season. It's been a lot of fun. I hope that you've learned something or enjoyed it. At the very least, I've enjoyed it, so hopefully that's shown through a little bit. I've had a lot of fun. Thank you to everyone who hopped on this season. It was a blast getting to catch up with some people and also just to learn about their stories in ways that I probably hadn't, even for some of the people who are my closer friends that I got to do this with. So, you know the schedule. We'll see you in 2024 for season 3, and probably 2028 for the blank season is what I'm officially going to call it. Season 4 will be our zero episode blank season. But yeah, thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.